Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Sarah Hurwitz, presidential speechwriter and author of the new book, Here All Along, Finding Meaning, Spirituality, and a Deeper Connection to Life in Judaism, after finally choosing to look there. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at 2JewishRadio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on 2 Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. 2 Jewish is paid for by 2 Jewish Radio programs and podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and 2 Jewish.
Shalom. We're now just 2 weeks before Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year. It begins Sunday night, September 25th. This is a wonderful time to look back on the year that's nearly passed in our lives, examine our conduct, and see the ways in which we can return to being the best that we have within us. Today, we're also commemorating the 21st anniversary of 9/11. While the memory of that terrible day has faded into history for most of us, Judaism is a religion that focuses on the importance of preserving memory, of learning from our past. The World Trade Center and Pentagon murders perpetrated by Al-Qaeda were a brutal destruction of life, and the responses these horrific acts provoked led to death and destruction around the world. Nearly 3,000 people were murdered on 9/11, and the circles of grief and loss extended far beyond the many victims, to their families, friends, and communities, to the serious health and psychological problems of first responders and all of those within the range of that destruction. That emotional trauma severely damaged our nation and our world. 9/11 changed many things, virtually none of them for the good. Forces were unleashed we scarcely understand even now, 21 years later, and over which we are not really in control. I personally chaired 9/11 commemorations here in Tucson for 10 years, coordinated and participated in many events remembering those who died. In every one of those ceremonies, we chose to create bonds of respect, honor, and love across all boundary lines of religion and race. We did this because it was right. But we also did this because we needed to demonstrate to those who perform such despicable acts in the hopes of destroying human solidarity that they can create the opposite effect. Their acts of violence and evil brought Americans together and engendered respect, understanding, and love among people with varying beliefs and of different races and origins. Over the decade of the 9/11 commemorations I chaired and the many I participated in later, it was clear that interest just waned over time. In 2001, we all needed to gather, share, pray, and heal one another. In 2002, we still needed to gather to pray, mourn, and remember, but each year thereafter, no matter how moving the ceremonies or how broad a group we gathered, our high was 24 different religious denominations represented in Tucson Multi-Faith Alliance services. The numbers of attendees just diminished. It's the way of the world. Immediate tragedy becomes memory and then quickly moves into history before we even notice. This year, I suspect most of us see this date as a time to mourn those whose lives were stolen from them over 2 decades ago. Some see it as a time to focus on the war against terrorism and religious insanity, the radical evil form of Saudi Islam that intoxicated the perpetrators of 9/11 and still threatens civilization in many parts of the world. But some of us choose to see this 9/11 date as a reminder of what America can be when it decides to be. At a time of great trauma and crisis, what was most extraordinary was the way all Americans pulled together. We reached out across boundary lines of race, creed, color, and politics, and supported each other. Arizonans, Southerners, Midwesterners all cared suddenly about New York. Red state and blue state differences didn't matter. Republicans and Democrats bonded over shared tragedy and the dedication to healing, to strength, to pride. I suggest we look back in a different way at the aftermath of 9/11, not because there was anything to be nostalgic about. It was horror and disaster, a national loss of innocence and the sense of security, but there was a quality to the way we Americans responded then that can teach us something essential we seem to have forgotten recently. After 9/11, when things seemed blackest, Americans chose to seek each other's understanding, respect, support, love, and to offer those to one another freely and with concern and care. Thank God and our U.S. intelligence services, we do not face another 9/11 today. But at a time of ever-increasing national discord and division, of the endless online cultivation of mutual disrespect and hatred, of insane media pronouncements all the time, we can take an essential lesson from that terrible time. We can personally and collectively choose to build respect, understanding, support, and love into our society. We can reach out across religious lines and celebrate the greatest strength of America, our amazing diversity. We can demonstrate caring and kindness in place of anger and hostility. We can show respect for one another's faith, race, gender, identity, even politics. We can choose to do what Americans are supposed to do. Reject the temptations of easy stereotyping and quick judgment. And then we can do what Americans are best at in a pinch. We can pull together and seek to make our country and perhaps our world truly better, more generous, more respectful, more gracious, more peaceful. God knows this world can use it. Play us in this morning, 2 weeks away from Rosh Hashanah. Here's a setting for the coming High Holy Days in the Shofar service. Areshet Sfatenu, may the prayers of our lips be acceptable to you, God, during this time of return and repentance. This particular version is one of the few good things to come out of the pandemic, an online recording from an a cappella quartet of the Great Park Synagogue Choir. Areshet Sfatenu, Areshet Sfatenu, Yerav Lefanecha Er HaMenisa, Mevinu Mazin, Mevinu Mazin, Mabitu Makshiv, Mabitu Makshiv, Mevinu Mazin, Mabitu Makshiv. That was Areshet Sfatenu for Rosh Hashanah and the coming High Holy Days. They begin with Slichot this Saturday night, September 17th. Rosh Hashanah is 2 weeks from tonight and tomorrow, September 25th and 26th. It's time to join a synagogue near you. You know, like my own, Congregation Beit Simcha, right here in Tucson. Our guest this morning, Sarah Hurwitz, was a prominent political speechwriter for a variety of important politicians, including President Obama, and then for years for Michelle Obama. She's the author of the excellent new book, Here All Along, Finding Meaning, Spirituality, and a Deeper Connection to Life in Judaism, after finally choosing to look there. Find out how she became a speechwriter, why and how she moved on, when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors. and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson. Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome the Two Jewish this morning. Our guest, Sarah Hurwitz, is an American speechwriter, which doesn't quite capture it. She was the senior speechwriter for President Barack Obama for a couple of years, and then the head speechwriter for First Lady Michelle Obama for 7 more years, was appointed to serve on the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Council by President Obama, and has written a terrific book about her discovery. I won't say rediscovery, about her discovery of her Jewish identity. The book is called Here All Along, Finding Meaning, Spirituality, and a Deeper Connection to Life in Judaism. After finally choosing to look there, that's the longest title I can think of. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me. And you are right that my title is quite long, quite long. It's a very chatty kind of title.
So this is kind of an, I don't know, softball question, but maybe not. What took you so long speaking as a rabbi?
Totally fair question. You know, funny, I grew up like I think a lot of American Jews grow up, where, you know, there wasn't a lot of Judaism in my home, but my parents wanted us to have a Jewish identity. So they sent us to Hebrew school, which we didn't like, and dragged us to synagogue services twice a year at the High Holy Days, which we also didn't like. And that was the Judaism. And so by the time I became a bat mitzvah, I thought, well, if that's the Judaism, then I, you know, it's a free country. Judaism is a religion. I can decide what religion I am, putting that in quotations, that it's not just a religion, but I did not know that. And I thought, look, I'm out. You know, I'm a cultural Jew, Jew by heritage, but if I want to find meaning and spirituality, I'll just have to look elsewhere. Well, fast forward 25 years later, I broke up with a guy I was dating at the age of 36. I was very lonely and anxious, had a lot of time on my hands, and I happened to hear about an Intro to Judaism class at the local JCC. I signed up just to fill time. It could have been a ceramics class or a karate class. I would have done it. You know, it was kind of just total luck. But in that class, I was blown away. You know, I found 4,000 years of wisdom from millions of people, my ancestors, about what it means to be human, how to be a good person, how to lead a worthy life, how to find connection with the divine in an adult, mature way, not a God is the man in the sky who grants wishes. And I just thought, you know, where has this been all my life? And I think if you're a Jew like me, whose only point of connection is a couple of High Holiday services, you are not going to see what is so extraordinary about our tradition. And so I started learning and reading, and I just decided I want to share this with other Jews and anyone interested in Judaism. I think that, you know, it's just not something you necessarily see if you're engaging with Judaism, as many American Jews do.
There's a phrase that clergy use sometimes for most Americans. They're called the unchurched. It means people that don't really connect at all. What do you think it was that you found? That what was the spark?
You know, I think it was a number of things. Number one, it was understanding the project and process of Judaism. You know, I think as a kid, you know, you hear some stuff about the Torah, you read it, it seems kind of crazy and violent, and oh, how could this be? But when I, you know, when I actually started engaging, I realized that the project and process of Judaism was, the Torah was the beginning. And we have now spent 2,500 years interpreting it, engaging with it, arguing about it. You know, I began to understand that Judaism is this centuries-long conversation where we are trying to continue to hear the voice of the divine in our own generation. You know, what happened, what we think, you know, whether you believe it literally or metaphorically, what we think happened at Mount Sinai, where, you know, God kind of gives the Israelites the Torah, it basically presents them with a covenant, which they can accept or reject. You know, that we continue to try to hear that revelation in our own time. So I love that process. I also just love the central core metaphor of Judaism, which is of a God who presents to a people a covenant that they can accept or reject. You know, this contemplates quite an engaged and empowered set of human beings. It really puts an emphasis on human empowerment and responsibility that I personally found really thrilling. I also think the way that we as Jews engage with God with this incredible humility and complexity. You know, there is, as you know, there's no dogma, there's no creed, there's no definition of the divine that you have to accept or reject. You know, if that were the case, I think that would be a form of idolatry, you know, shrinking God, this ineffable, infinite thing, to the size that our little human minds can contemplate. We as Jews have the humility not to do that. So instead of theology, what we have is centuries and centuries of commentary, different conceptions and ideas of the divine according to people's own experiences and Jewish tradition. I found that really exciting and thrilling. And, you know, I just, overall, the sophistication, the depth, the fact that you can always go a layer deeper with Judaism. You know, this was not something simplistic or childish. This was not something where I have to kind of accept a bunch of stuff despite all evidence to the contrary. That's not what Judaism is. And I was just blown away and continue to be.
We will talk much more with Sarah Horwitz about her journey to Judaism as a Jew when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish. The Jewish High Holy Days are coming. Where are you going? Why not join us at Congregation Beit Simcha? Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a wonderful Jewish synagogue in the northwest of Tucson, Catalina Foothills, celebrates a fantastic array of services, classes, events, and social action programs this fall. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. Progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the whole metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services Friday night and Saturday morning, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, cultural Jewish programming, and of course, High Holy Day services. Join us in person for the High Holy Days or Shabbat services, or come on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimcha Tucson.org. We welcome members and guests in our sanctuary safely and in person. Call 520-276-5675 for more information. Religious school has begun for school-age children or grandchildren. Join us in our fabulous Hebrew school, Bar and Bat Mitzvah programs, Torah Tikes experience, confirmation, and teen programs in a fun, relaxed setting with great Jewish learning. For Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, members and guests are warmly welcomed in our sanctuary. But you can also attend online on our Facebook page. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimcha Tucson, to sign up. Beit Simcha Synagogue is located at 2270 West Ina Road, north side of Ina, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property in our own building. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Come in person Friday night or Saturday morning or both. You can join us Friday night on our Facebook page as well. Shabbat evening celebration services are always at 6:30 p.m. Saturday Shabbat morning services are at 10 a.m., preceded by Torah study at 9 o'clock, all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Our Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson. Our musical services are in person and by virtual experience. All of our Adult Education Academy classes, and there are many wonderful ones, are live and on Zoom. Free one this afternoon at 2 o'clock on the prayer book. You can access those by going to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or emailing me, rabbi@BeitSimchaTucson.org. Our religious school is available in blended format, too. Most students live, some coming on Zoom. For more information about Beit Simcha, to come to services, our fabulous religious school and Torah Tikes programs, Bar and Bat Mitzvah, confirmation, high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses taught live and on Zoom, and of course, all of our services in person and on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org. Or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675. BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, for the coming High Holy Days in the fastest growing Jewish congregation in all of Arizona in its exciting beginning years. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOO Jewish Radio 18@gmail. Or visit our website, 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcasts. Top 10 in North America, according to Moment Magazine. Over 175,000 downloads on Podbean and available, well, wherever podcasts are heard. Please post a rating. Review 2 Jewish wherever you listen to our podcast. Those comments help. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So, last time you told us about a very unusual part of the Jewish world, the Piemonte, another interesting place for Jews, or a place where you don't think about Jews being, American service people get stationed everywhere. Tell us a little story about that.
Well, the story concerns Romania, where you certainly do think of Jews as being.
Yes, there are many Jews from Romania.
Great numbers.
Yeah. I mean, there were many Jews in Romania.
There still are.
Still some.
Particularly in the parts of Romania that are Hungarian-speaking, the so-called Transylvania. But this story involves a former student of mine at the University of Arizona who was a Mormon who grew up in Montana and was always one of these, you know, God and country guys, and did the Reserve Officers Training Corps as an undergrad, went into the Army with the intention of doing that for the rest of his life, and has been in the Army now for probably 10 years. And so he's rising through the ranks. He's a very capable guy. We don't agree on everything, obviously. His personal hero was Rush Limbaugh, and he eulogized Rush Limbaugh at great length when he passed away. But Zach has always been very interested in Jewish customs and history. He's an avid fan of my podcast. And
well, that makes him a good person no matter what, right. Obviously.
So he recently reached out to me to say that some of his colleagues in the Army were praying, as they do every day, which tends to mean to me that they're probably Orthodox, and they asked him if he had any idea where they could go for the High Holy Days. So he sent me a text saying, what are the High Holy Days and where should they go? So I gave him a quick explanation of one.
Or you could have directed him to 2 Jewish. We always explain the High Holy Days. Okay, go ahead.
And, yeah, but who knows when?
Of course.
Mean, anyway, he just wanted a quick thumbnail sketch.
Yes, so of got course. It. I understand.
And then I contacted my friend who's the chief rabbi of Montenegro, who's actually a Chabad guy from L.A., and he, of course, knows the chief Chabad rabbi in Romania, and there are several. And this guy is involved with training all the chaplains and with taking care of Jewish servicemen. Now, this particular detachment where my former student is stationed is discreet. It's low key, it's low profile. It's on the Black Sea, and it's part of the movement to reassure our NATO allies in Eastern Europe that we're there with them during this
Russians
tense time.
Putin, right. Ukraine. Okay. Yeah.
So this guy eventually called the rabbi in Bucharest, who gave him full information and was very welcoming. And his Jewish colleagues will have a place to go for the high holidays.
Fantastic. Look, by the way, anybody who needs a place to go for the high holy days, there's always a synagogue that's available. Obviously, there's plenty of online options as well. And no one is really turned away. So it's an important concept. Jews who come to do their tshuva, to do their return, this is a good time to do it, whether you're in Romania or in Tucson or anywhere around the world. Thanks so much, Tom. We will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Mr. and Mrs. Goldberg just got married. On their way to their honeymoon, Goldberg turned to his new wife and asked, "Darling, would you have married me if my father hadn't left me a fortune?" And she replied, "Honey, I would have married you no matter who left you a fortune." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. How do we go about changing our world, and how long should it take? This week's portion, Ki Tavo, gives us powerful commandments about how to live in society. We are to be moral, to protect the rights of the impoverished, the widow, the stranger. We are supposed to be honest in business, careful of the needs of the hungry and homeless. We must create a society of ethical practice and moral concern. We should understand a nation is judged by how it treats its weakest, neediest members. And we are told repeatedly that God knows and expects us to live to this covenant, this brit, to uphold it, cherish it, make it our own. We are told of the blessings that will be ours if we do this, and the curses that we bring on ourselves if we cannot. This covenant was large and challenging. It put real responsibilities on its members, its B'nai B'rit, to do things that weren't easy or obvious, even if they were right. No doubt our ancient Israelite ancestors sometimes struggled when told to open your hands to the poor and the needy, to welcome the stranger, to love your neighbor as you love yourself. I'm sure people didn't always manage to give their full tithes or make the pilgrimage to the temple to declare gratitude for what they had. I'll even bet there were times they didn't provide adequately for the widow or the orphan. But that challenge, the daily requirement to try to live to this standard, made them nonetheless better people and made Jewish society egalitarian and generally ethical. When they failed, they learned that what God wanted was tshuva, a return to the right course. Positive societal change was not instantaneous, but evolutionary. But it did happen for our ancestors and was codified as a practical framework for life by the rabbis of the Talmud. These standards should have at least as much meaning for us today. When something isn't right, we need to speak up and seek change. That's what the Torah teaches us in Ki Tavo. And it is what God requires of us, no matter how long it might take to make that change. When we come back on Too Jewish, our guest this morning, the delightful Sarah Hurwitz, presidential speechwriter supreme, shares how she found Jewish understanding and commitment as a sophisticated adult, and why her journey can help all of us. When we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary. Our brothers.
At a ceremony held on the airbase where 11 Israeli athletes and coaches were murdered during the 1972 Munich Olympics, German officials apologized for the lack of protection that led to the tragedy. They also agreed to establish a joint research commission to look deeply into the events surrounding the terror attack. "We cannot make amends for what has happened," said German President Frank-Walter Steinmeier. "I ask you, as head of state of this country and on behalf of the Federal Republic of Germany, for forgiveness for the lack of protection of the Israeli athletes during the Olympic Games in Munich, and for the lack of clarification afterwards, for the fact that what happened could happen." Germany also reached a compensation deal of about $28 million with the attack's surviving family members just days before the commemoration, a significant increase from a previous offer that staved off a planned boycott of the ceremony by the victims' families. "Today, 50 years afterwards, many questions, far too many, remain unanswered," Steinmeier said. "The attack was followed by years of decades of silence and blocking out. That, too, is a failure. Honored family members, I cannot fathom what suffering, what pain you've been through. How can life go on," he added, "for 5 decades that gnawing pain has been with you." Israeli President Isaac Herzog, who threatened to join the family boycott, attended the ceremony and addressed the Bundestag, Germany's parliament, praising its government for the apology, finally an apology, and welcoming a proposal by Bundestag President Barbel Bas to create a new German-Israeli youth exchange organization. Isaac Herzog thanked Steinmeier and German Chancellor Olaf Scholz for taking responsibility and contributing to some relief of the pain that relatives still have today. Of course, September 5th, 1972, 8 terrorists from the Palestinian terrorist group Black September entered the Olympic Village, taking members of the Israeli delegation hostage, demanding the release of Palestinian political prisoners held in Israel and elsewhere. After a botched rescue attempt, 11 Israelis and 1 West German police officer were murdered by the end of the night. Herzog capped this trip with a visit to the memorial at Bergen-Belsen, the former concentration camp. His father, Chaim Herzog, who later became Israel's 6th president, helped liberate the camp in April 1945, while he was serving as a British Army officer. In other news from Israel, an Israeli soldier likely fired the gunshot that killed Palestinian-American journalist Shireen Abu Akleh back in May. An analysis released by the Israeli Defense Forces finally concluded this. But no one who was present during the killing, including the soldier likely to have fired the fatal shot, will be punished, military officials of the IDF said. The army released a statement saying it was still possible that Abu Akleh had been killed by Palestinian gunfire. The official conclusion marked a shift from the Israeli government's previous positions about what happened. At first, officials said they believed a Palestinian was likely to have killed Abu Akleh, citing a video they said was from the scene. Soon after, they conceded it possible that an Israeli soldier had fired. They couldn't know for sure, they said. Over the following months, the U.S., the U.N., and multiple media organizations concluded, after conducting their own investigations, that the gunshot had likely come from an Israeli soldier. The new Israeli agreement with this conclusion says there is a high likelihood an Israeli shot killed Abu Akleh, respected journalist for Al Jazeera, who was wearing a flak jacket identifying her as a member of the press. An IDF official said this last week that a single soldier had been identified as likely to have fired the fatal shot. The shooting took place as Abu Akleh and other journalists were reporting on an IDF operation in Jenin, the West Bank city that has become a stronghold for Palestinian terrorists. Abu Akleh's family said it was not satisfied with Israel's admission of likely culpability. They want an investigation and trial by the International Criminal Court and for the U.S. to press for greater accountability for the journalist's death. In other news from Israel, after a string of terrorist attacks within Israel earlier this year, the army has been engaged in an extended crackdown against Palestinian terrorists. Frequent raids in the West Bank resulted in 85 deaths since the beginning of the year, according to the Palestinian Health Authority. Israeli officials say they have conducted more than 2,000 operations and arrested more than 1,500 people suspected of being terrorists. An Israeli operation targeting Palestinian Islamic Jihad leaders in the West Bank and Gaza triggered a brief exchange of hostilities last month. Last week also, Israeli forces raised the Jenin home of the man identified as being responsible for the fatal Palestinian terrorist shootings that killed three people and wounded 11 on Dizengoff Street in Tel Aviv in April. Israeli forces said they are pursuing many members of the man's family suspected of terrorist activity. And finally, Lebanese protesters last week sailed down the coast in dozens of fishing boats and yachts towards Israel just days before a U.S. envoy arrived in Beirut to continue mediating a maritime border dispute between Lebanon and Israel. They have officially been at war since Lebanon declared war on the brand new state of Israel back in 1948. Both claim an area of 330 square miles off the coast in the Mediterranean Sea. Lebanon hopes to exploit offshore gas reserves, huge reserves there, by the way, as it grapples with its worst economic crisis. Lebanon and Israel kicked off maritime border talks 2 years ago, but they haven't resolved the issue yet. Last week's little flotilla carried Lebanese flags and banners with slogans in Arabic, French, and Hebrew expressing what they say is Lebanon's right to its maritime oil and gas fields. "We demand our right to every inch of our waters," Aya Salah, one of the protesters, said. "We are sending a message from the Lebanese people." Lebanese and Israeli Navy vessels were present, though no confrontations occurred. Amos Hochstein, a senior advisor for energy security at the U.S. State Department, has been shuttling between Beirut and Jerusalem to mediate talks. He was in Beirut in late July. He told Lebanese officials then of Israel's response to a proposal Lebanon made in June and signaled optimism after his trip. He is in Israel this week and will be in Beirut after. Lebanese media speculate that the two countries may soon reach an agreement. However, tensions between Lebanon's Iran-backed terrorist Shiite group Hezbollah and Israel continue to simmer. The Israeli military shot down three Hezbollah unarmed drones flying over the disputed Karish gas field in the Mediterranean back in July. Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah then said that the terror group can locate and strike Karish and any other Israeli gas field. Lebanese caretaker Prime Minister Najib Mikati criticized Hezbollah then, saying any such moves could pose risks to the country. Yep. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews round the world. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation, known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We welcome back the Two Jewish, our guest this morning. Sarah Hurwitz was speechwriter for President Barack Obama, for First Lady Michelle Obama, and actually started her speech writing career at a super high level, writing for Hillary Clinton's unsuccessful first presidential campaign. Her new book, which is a great read, is called Here All Along, Finding Meaning, Spirituality, and a Deeper Connection to Life in Judaism. So how does someone become a speechwriter? I mean, do you wake up one morning and, you know, you gone to great schools and you decide, oh, well, my goal is to write words for somebody else?
I wish it were that easy. No, actually, I didn't really. I wish I'd started with Secretary Clinton, but actually, I got my start as an intern back in the summer of 1998.
For Al Gore, right?
For Al Gore, that's right, in his speechwriting office. And the writers I worked for, they helped me get my first very junior job right after college, which was as the assistant to the speechwriter to Lieutenant Governor of Maryland. As glamorous as it sounded, and I, you know, I did that. I was a speechwriter for a senator.
Who knew that a lieutenant governor even needed his speechwriter? Sorry.
I know, right? Who knew? And then, you know, I worked for a number of losing campaigns, and then I worked for a winning campaign. So it was a lot of kind of lower level jobs and a lot of losing campaigns.
It's always impressed me. I mean, you know, you watch West Wing or something, I don't know, TV shows about speechwriters. Is it like a group of people in a room hacking through ideas? Is it one person? Like, is it, how does it work?
So it is, you know, in the Obama White House, it was one person, one speech, except for the State of the Union, which was two people. It's quite inefficient to try to write a speech as a group. Although actually, I know some of President George W. Bush's speechwriters were lovely people, and they actually, three of them, would sit down and write together, which I was just,
wow,
you know, mind-boggling to me. But I think they just developed this incredible rapport and connection, and they could do that. But, you know, for us, it was one person, one speech.
So
we did often, you know, talk to each other, brainstorm ideas, get help. So it wasn't totally solitary.
This is a strange question, perhaps, but there are a lot of theories about the evolution of the Torah, whether it was redacted, given by God at Mount Sinai, a collective effort over hundreds of years, maybe even 1,000 years. As a literary person, as someone who's used to creating words that are effective, even famously effective, looking at the document of the Torah, what do you think it is?
Oh, interesting question. So, you know, I do believe it was authored by humans, perhaps divinely inspired. I do, you know, I do believe the academic research that says that it was, you know, compiled, sort of redacted over a period of time, often using kind of older texts and traditions as well. So, you know, as a literary person, as a speechwriter, something I love about this text is that it's not possible to read it without interpreting it. You know, it's so sparse. The language is so spare. You have to engage with it. You have to fill it in, which is what we have done for 2,500 years. It's quite extraordinary. And I think, you know, when people kind of read it without any of the benefits of the oral Torah, all the commentaries since then, that's not a Jewish way to read our sacred text. The Jewish way to read our sacred text is to read it in the context and with the benefit of all these commentaries since it was redacted, since it was published. And I think when you do that, you become part of this really rich tradition of conversation, debate, argument, constantly trying to get to the deepest truths of it. And so I think as a document, the very structure and nature of it is what allows for that process. So I think it's quite an extraordinary document.
So if you were revising it, giving you the authority of the rabbis, how would you change it?
Goodness, that is an amazing question. You know, I can't fathom changing any of it. It's just such a great question. What would I do if I were going to revise? I mean, I think, you know, you could say, oh, I'd go back through and kind of, you know, clean up some of the repeated sections where there are two or three takes on a certain moment, where each slightly different than the other, but I don't know. Those differing takes often reveal different dimensions of the same thing. So I'm not, you know, I don't think I could see myself changing it.
Well,
maybe some of the really extreme violence I might want to soften.
Soften it a little bit, use of euphemisms,
yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, maybe, but that was time, right? It was a product of its time.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. Every now and then this comes up when in Torah study or in one of our close reading classes, and I say, you know, this section really belongs before that section. Obviously, no one's, if someone gave me the power to make that transformation.
The thing is, we've just, you know, that's sort of to read the Torah without the 2,500 years of commentary,
yeah,
which is just not a Jewish way to read it.
Of course.
It's sort of like, maybe the reason I'm having so much trouble is because I know that each of those weird repetitions or strange orderings has been the source of generations of commentary. And I can't bear the thought of losing those generations of commentary.
What's your favorite part about rediscovering Judaism as an adult?
A great question. You know, I think it's just the reality that this rediscovery has, it's given me a much deeper way to live my life. You know, it's helped me discover a much higher ethical bar than that of the secular world, which is pretty much just you do you, as long as you don't hurt other people too much. You know, that's sort of the modern secular ethic. Do what you want as long as you don't hurt other people too much. And that's a pretty low bar. And even the kind of higher bar that I used to live by of, oh, be nice, you know, do social justice, help others. It's like, well, what does that really mean? You know, once I started really digging into Jewish ethical law, it's like, oh, wow. It's not just give to the poor. It's how do you give to the poor? Do you do it in a way that empowers them, that embarrasses them? You know, it's how do I use my speech every day? Am I shaming people? Am I gossiping? You know, it's set a much higher ethical bar for me to strive for, which makes me feel like I'm living a deeper life. You know, it's exposed me to an entire way of thinking about the divine that has actually allowed me to have a sense of a connection to that, which before I couldn't because I had this God is a man in the sky idea, which I just couldn't buy. And, you know, it's connected me to an extraordinary community of other Jews, you know, all across the world, people of just every possible way of doing Judaism. You know, I've studied with very progressive rabbis. I've studied with a very ultra-Orthodox rabbi who, you know, we disagreed on a lot of things quite vehemently, but I learned a tremendous amount from him, and I really like him very much. And it's tied me to a community back through time. You know, I can learn from Maimonides. I can learn from Rabbi Akiva. I can learn from, you know, feminist theorists. Like, I'm now part of something that is so much bigger and so much deeper than myself. And it's just enriched my life in ways that I can't even begin to articulate. I feel tremendously lucky to have randomly signed up for this class because of a breakup. I mean, how silly is that, right? So there's that strange little, you know, turn of circumstance has just led to this incredible awakening.
You know, it can happen at any time to anyone for any reason. And sometimes there's this one book that says there are no coincidences. You know, there's no chance. It's meant to happen when it's meant to happen. I'm not sure I agree with that, but there's a little bit of beshert in all of this.
There is. That is true.
I'm not surprised that a writer decided to write about the experience. Why did you decide to write a book?
Yeah, you know, it's funny, when I was on my own Jewish learning journey, I found it really hard. You know, and I think of myself as a smart person, as, you know, someone with a lot of education, but when I was...
You mean like Harvard and Harvard Law, like that counts as education today?
Gosh. I mean, whatever, you know, it's fine. But I, you know, my choices were some really excellent Intro to Judaism books that I found very helpful for the kind of nuts and bolts and how-to. But when I was looking for the why to, I felt like a lot of times my options were these very academic, you know, just painfully dense books that I had to kind of slog through. And I kept asking myself, where is the book that I'm looking for? A book that, yes, covers the how to, but much more dives deeply into the why to, that really unearths the deepest, most radical, profound, transformative, life-changing wisdom that has to offer, and that makes it accessible but doesn't dumb it down. And I just, you know, I struggled to find that. And at some point, I was talking to a friend, and he said, you keep talking about this. Why don't you write that book? And I was like, no, I'm not a rabbi. I'm not a scholar. Who am I? He's just like, you know, he was like, Sarah, you know, lots of journalists, you know, write a book about a topic they know nothing about, but they learn deeply, and then they write that book. What's the difference here? I thought, that's actually a good point. Once I started writing the book, I did realize just why this kind of book doesn't really exist. This was tremendously difficult. Judaism really does resist translation. It does resist kind of, you know, simple sentences, because there's always an exception to an exception to an exception. And that was, you know, it kind of made Righthouse speech writing look very easy in comparison. Writing this book was the hardest writing project I've ever experienced. But, you know, it was amazing. It's an amazing learning experience, and now getting to share it with people, getting to travel to communities and meet people, it's been amazing.
I want to thank Sarah Hurwitz for an amazing visit and a terrific book. By the way, I think a lot of times the most valuable books are the popularizing books. People call it that, but it means the ones that are accessible, that teach about Judaism in meaningful ways that relate to the way people actually think about things. So you're right. You don't have to have been a lifelong scholar of Judaism to write something that has value right now. Where can people go to find out more about you and to find out more about the book?
Yeah, so my website is just sarahhurwitz.net, sarahhurwitz.net. I'm on Twitter at Here All Along. Literally, my handle is at Here All Along. I don't love social media, so it's the world's worst Twitter account, but it gives you some ideas.
Mine might be worse, let's be honest.
Yeah, and the book is available wherever you buy books, ideally at your local bookstore, or you can get it online at Amazon or anywhere else where you get books. And there is both an audiobook and it's available on Kindle as well.
So, and a final question, are you going to go back to speech writing for somebody? I suspect you're in demand.
I thank you for the question. No, I'm really done with speech writing. It was an amazing experience, but I'm actually hoping to write another book. So that is hopefully what's next for me.
I hope it's about Judaism, speaking selfishly.
Yes, it will be.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
When we come back here on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson. Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Thanks for being here this morning with us on Too Jewish. And with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. Our guest will be Martha Ann Toll, author of the wonderful new novel, Three Muses. Don't forget, join us at Congregation Beit Simcha for the High Holy Days, or come in person every Friday night for services in Oneg Shabbat starting at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning too, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading and Kiddush, live in person and on our Facebook page, Beit Simcha Tucson, and the Jewish High Holy Days, just 2 weeks from tonight. Join us in person or attend online. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org for more information how to come to Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur and celebrate the new year with Beit Simcha. Our playout this morning features Cantor Naftali Hirschtig, formerly the Chazan at the Great Synagogue in Jerusalem, a past teacher of mine as a singer, singing Uvenucha Yomar by Lewandowski for the coming High Holy Days. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, a healthy week, and a week we pray profoundly of peace.
Thank you.
sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.